Today on Wings, Asylum Seekers at the U.S. Border.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
We stuffed the gallon water jugs in our backpacks and headed out into terrain that for me was really unexpected.
Deborah Cohen carried water and pairs of socks into the desert along the Mexico-U.S. border. Four women have been arrested for doing that, but they were trespassing in a federal wildlife refuge. Cohen went with an artist who places crosses where migrants' bodies have been found.
We found ourselves traversing gullies and going up hills and crossing over rocky areas. It was really, really overwhelming, particularly when we stopped and thought about the fact that we were most likely walking in the same footsteps that many of the migrants walked before they met their deaths.
Migrants who survive the trip north from Latin America are likely to be turned away at the U.S. border, but some still get a chance to apply for refugee status. If they can prove they have a credible fear of death at home, and if they have sponsors inside the U.S., they may get to stay in the country while they wait for a decision. Melinda Tuhus traveled to Arizona and Mexico to record refugees and the Good Samaritans who helped them.
Okay, entonces, bienvenidos. Vamos a hacer un aplauso para que ya están afuera.
That's Catherine Smith, site coordinator at the former Benedictine Monastery in Tucson, now serving as a temporary shelter for migrant families who have passed the credible fear hearing. She was welcoming one of the daily groups of 50 to 100 migrants who are brought to the monastery in buses operated by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. She told them to give a cheer because they were now out of U.S. immigration custody. I interviewed her a little later.
So these are all people who are seeking asylum in the U.S., and they're processed by ICE, and they've passed a credible fear interview, which is kind of saying that they have a fear of returning to their home country, and they also are kind of in this lucky group of people that do have a U.S. sponsor. They're released on humanitarian parole, which is 6 months permission to be in the U.S., and in that 6 months, they check in with ICE, and ICE will give them a court date, a hearing, and that's when they'll start their asylum case, and from there, it could be denied right away, or it could go on for months with different hearings with a lawyer and things like that.
This is my third day that I've been here for part or all of the day. On Sunday, it was hardly anybody here. And then yesterday, 90 more people came. And I hear today another 100 people are coming. And most of the people yesterday, I think, were from Guatemala.
Mm-hmm. I've been here for a year and a half now. And I would say that we definitely see the highest amount of people coming from Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, southern Mexico. The majority being from Guatemala, and then within that, probably around 40% of the people coming from Guatemala are from indigenous communities.
This space seems incredibly well organized. You did the whole thing, you set it up in a couple of days?
Yeah, I was even out of town when we moved in here, but I knew that we had access to this space, you know, a huge, beautiful old monastery, and we were thinking about kind of setting up, you know, for a week and just making sure everything was ready till we would receive people. And then we got notice that, you know, no, there's a large amount of people. And if you don't take them right now, we're going to send them to the streets or to the Greyhound bus station. So in 2 days, they pretty much just set up everything. And yeah, the community has just stepped up so much. 99.9% of everyone here is a volunteer, and you see so many people come throughout the day.
So tell me, what are the services that people can get while they're here?
Mm-hmm. After we welcome people and explain to them where they are, we will offer them first, right away, just water and fruit to kind of get them, if they are coming dehydrated, to kind of get some liquids in their system. And then right away, we will start with a medical screening, and that's with nurses and doctors who are here every day. And so we'll do kind of just a check-in to see if there are serious medical issues. If there are, we will take them to the actual doctor's office. And from there, if they do need to go to the hospital, we'll take them to the hospital. So the main thing at first is medical care. And then from there, we will the service of connecting them with their family members. And so, like I said, a lot of people are coming without money and without phones. And so we'll bridge that gap of communication and help them connect with their families, their sponsors, and then obviously serve three meals a day. There's always food available, always coffee. And we'll offer them new clothes. They're donated clothes, but they can pick a new pair of clothes to them, shoes, belts. We'll offer them like shampoo, conditioner, chapstick, lotion, different toiletries like that. And then obviously a room. Sometimes they'll be sleeping on a cot in a larger room, but at least a bed and a blanket.
Better than they had under the bridge in El Paso.
Yes, yes. And you can just see people are coming just so tired and not necessarily dirty, but just worn out, you know, wearing the same clothes for weeks on end, just super chapped lips and just really wanting a shower. And I think a lot of that is what we've set up against migrants. It's dehumanizing. On purpose, a lot of this system is dehumanizing. And so maybe, yeah, they're sleeping on a cot here, but from where they're coming from, they can regain that humanity and help us sweep and help us cook in the kitchen and things that help them, you know, feel like a person again. Because at home, those are the things that they would be doing.
So part of the MO here is for people, the guests, to actually do chores as well as the volunteers do some of the same kinds of chores.
Yeah, we ask that they are helpful with those types of things. I mean, if we have 200 guests here, we don't have 200 volunteers as a personal person to help them with everything. So yes, we'll ask them to help sweep the kitchen, help mop the floors, clean off the tables, fold their laundry, and just small things like that. And I've never had anyone, you know, if I'm asking someone to sweep or something, I've never had anyone say no. It's usually people coming up to me saying, how can I help? Is there anything that I can do? Like, do you need me to take out the trash? And sometimes I don't have anything for anyone to do. But for the most part, they want to help and they want to serve us. They're not paying to be here, but they want to show their gratitude, which helps them feel worthy as well.
People you're seeing now who are coming with families, including little babies and nursing babies and all that, are they pretty much all people who have taken buses up to the front, up to the border?
Most people that we see here are traveling, yes, by bus, close to the border that they can get, and then from there they will walk or take a taxi to a point of entry. Most of the people we see are crossing at points of entry as opposed to in the desert. But yeah, I've seen anywhere from people who have been traveling for 9 months to maybe just a few days. And so it kind of depends on how much money you have starting off the journey, but then also if this has been something that you've been thinking about for a while, or if something happened. I remember I met two, I think they were cousins, two women, and they came just kind of super quickly because their town had been burnt down by local kind of like fighting gangs. And so they were from a southern town in Mexico, and they just had to leave because their town didn't exist anymore, you know. But with that, they didn't necessarily have money saved up to take those buses and to pay off the cartel who are waiting at the border saying, you have to pay me before you even cross the border, no matter if it's at a point of entry or not, just because, yeah, the cartel.
The U.S. border.
The U.S., yes, U.S.-Mexico border. Yeah. And I think the number one word that I hear from people is extortion, and just small levels, high levels, no matter what it is, there's these organized crime that are just taking over Central America, and in parts they're in relation with the government, other times they're fighting the government, but it's just these gangs want a piece of the money that these people don't have. And when they can't offer that money to these teenagers who are truly threatening them, they don't know where to turn because they can't turn to their government. There's no one to turn to. And I think a lot of the unrest I know a lot of the unrest there is kind of product of what the U.S. has done in the past in Central America. And it's kind of now coming out that we supported pretty sad and negative things in Central America, and now they're the ones that are feeling the aftermath of that, and we're trying to say, no, we can't help you, even though we really did a lot to ruin those countries with so many different things. And I think right now too, something that gets overlooked is you'll hear people say they want to work here, and that's not a reason to seek asylum. And I think what is sad is that it's just kind of hidden that, like, climate change and what is going on and why can't you work in your home country? It's not because you're lazy. It's not because you're not looking for work or because you don't have a good resume. It's because the work that you've been doing in the past of farming and cultivating the land and having different crops instead of only corn and only coffee, you were able to live off of that. And now the demands of the U.S. saying, no, we only want coffee from you. We only want corn. And all of the things that we're doing here, every single person in the U.S. driving a car, those emissions are really affecting Central America. And so, yes, they're coming here to work, but it's because there's a drought in the tiny country of Guatemala and nobody can work anymore. And so there's just so many underlying things.
Catherine Smith, site coordinator at the monastery in Tucson.
On Wings, Melinda Tuhus covers Latin American refugees who seek to come to the United States and some of the people who help them.
Living in Arizona means doing a lot of driving, especially if you are a member of the Samaritans. Volunteers, almost all retirees, who drive into the Sonoran Desert on a weekly basis to look for migrants in need of help. They also walk weekly to leave water, snacks, and socks along what have been determined to be migrant trails. Samaritan Shura Wallen, who's been doing this work since 2001, explains.
We put water in strategic areas where we know that in the past and possibly now, though the routes have definitely changed and the traffic pattern is somewhat different, but we put gallons of water out, and we put Green Valley Samaritans on the bottle and the waypoint and the date when we put the water out, so that when we check the following week, we do this every week, when we check those spots, if we still see that there's a lot of water there, then it gives us a lot of information that people are no longer perhaps traveling through that area. If we find a bottle, let's say we put it on marker one, wherever that may be on the desert, and we find that bottle, marker one, at marker 10, that gives us a lot of information about A, people did go through, B, people did take the water, they used the water, and it substantiates what we're doing. And quite honestly, it doesn't matter to us who finds the water as long as the water saves the person's life. Now, most of the people that we are seeing are people who are applying for asylum. And that's why you see it's just absolutely unbelievable the number of children. Almost never saw children in all the years that I've worked there.
Everywhere we went, we heard about the cartels, which used to be called drug cartels, but now are at least as involved in smuggling humans as in smuggling drugs. And also, it turns out, in running those buses bringing families to the border. Shura was like a fairy godmother to dozens of migrant children living temporarily in Nogales, dispensing snacks, toys, and hugs and kisses. My main takeaway from accompanying her on two trips to the border was love.
We would never say to someone, by the way, do you have papers? By the way, are you with the cartels? Having been around so many migrants, I know that I have come into contact with cartel members, without question, okay? And basically, it doesn't frighten me at all, because, and I speak only for myself with this, because I know that I have helped them in some way or other. Even giving them a pair of socks helps them. And I really believe that the vast majority of people that I've come into contact with in Nogales would probably do anything for me if I needed help with anything. And so I have no idea what has put anybody in the place where that person stands at any given time. I don't know. I don't know whether someone, if someone's with the cartels, I don't know whether someone came to them with a gun to their head and said, you are doing this or you're dead. And not only are you dead, we're going to take your family out. And I say, what would you do? I would do exactly what that person wanted me to do, because A, I don't want to lose my life that way, and I definitely don't want my family to die. So I think that we have to look at these things and try to understand what would push someone into carrying drugs, into committing a crime, into anything that is against the law. And it's so easy to pass judgment.
Barbara Lemon is another Samaritan volunteer, and she was our driver one day as we toured the desert between Green Valley, a retirement community 45 miles south of Tucson, and the tiny town of Aravaca, a few miles from the border. She explained why she got involved.
Well, I had a couple friends that I knew in Mexico who lived down here, and I knew what kinds of things people were fleeing, and as they came in the desert, how many of them died. I was learning how many of them died in this desert, and I just felt that is ridiculous. I mean, it's a cruelty, and it is a planned cruelty because of the way that the border security built the fences in the urban areas so they couldn't cross there, and then forced them out into the desert. And the idea of that was that if they forced enough of them out into the desert and then they found it very inhospitable and they would die out there, then the word would get back and they would stop coming. Well, that is not what's going to happen. When you leave your home because it isn't safe for you to live, a lot of these people said, I have a choice to either die for sure at home and be killed on my own street or in my own house, or to risk dying in the desert or make it through the desert. And that's the choices they have.
So you wanted to play a part in helping them make it?
Yeah, I wanted to use my Spanish, and I knew what the people were coming from, and I wanted to help other people understand that.
Do you host groups like us a lot?
Very consistently.
is this your job now?
No, no. I drive search. I've been driving search for a few years. I'm not doing it much anymore because we have a bunch of drivers and I'm getting up. I'm 77. And,
I made you Shura.
Yeah, we are very close in age.
Lemon, who lived and worked in Mexico as a nurse, explained some of the history of the hemisphere.
The cartels are making huge amounts of money by taking over. The coyote business used to be families that would bring little groups up and they had connections. Now the cartels have taken that over as a money-making opportunity, and they are vicious and their prices are high. And so it's that's the reality here. And the more we push people out into the desert and don't let them through to claim asylum legally, the more we are giving money to the cartels. In Central America, if you would look at the timeline of the interference of the United States in South America, it would go clear back to the founding of this country. But primarily I'm thinking about starting even in the 50s, we overthrew the Guatemalan government because United Fruit wanted, they were going to nationalize the fruit industry, which would have really impacted our economy. So we overthrew that government. So that has been going on consistently. In the 60s, some people in these three target countries right now, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, began to rise up against their very rich economies that were led by rich families, but that people were poor, and they began to rebel about that. And the United States very consistently supported the rich families and the established government that was not democratic. We consistently supported that. And people may recall when we were sending troops for training in Honduras, or when Oliver North assisted folks with drug money so they could raise money for the Contras in Central America. So it's been a consistent interference by our government in their government, and not on the side of poor or regular citizens, but on the side of the rich. And it's been consistent. In the 60s we saw, or in the 80s we saw a flood of migrants from Central America. And that's when the sanctuary movement began here in Tucson. We saw that huge flood all along the border of Central Americans. And what often happened after that flood was people would come up here and settle and then not be accepted by local communities. And so they would band together and they formed gangs. And that's when you hear about MS-13 and Salvatruchas. Those gangs formed in the United States, in Los Angeles, in Chicago, and then they were gathered up and deported back to their homeland, where they didn't know anybody, where they may not even speak the language at this point, where their family had already been killed. So what do you do again but stick with your gang brothers? Now those gangs have pretty much taken over those three countries, including local police and extorting the government and being very corrupt. So the people now are fleeing that great pressure that they have. They lose their businesses, they're threatened with having their children kidnapped and killed, they're extorted for money on a monthly basis, and they finally just can't take it anymore and flee here, thinking that we're going to be welcoming to them.
I wasn't allowed to record or photograph any guests at the monastery, where I volunteered to arrange transportation and translated for some of the medical people giving everyone checkups. But in Nogales, I interviewed migrants at a shelter, at a feeding program, and in a tiny room right at the border crossing while they waited to make their asylum claims. They all described horrific conditions that caused them to flee, one from El Salvador and two from southern Mexico. Nelson, the Salvadoran, had worked previously in the U.S. and spoke English. He was waiting with his wife and five-year-old daughter in that tiny room.
When I come back in 2011, I was thinking that everything was, it can be different, right? But it wasn't. I started working for, I put like a small business, my own business. But they start coming to my business, right, and asking for money. It's really sad because all my things, my house, my furniture, and everything were. I lost everything.
They took everything.
They took everything. Yeah. We start like a process here. Every people who came here receive a number. All right. So, for example, I'm number 1,147. So there is so many numbers right now. As soon as they have, like, let's get an example, 10 people, so we are here. So that's the people who are about to cross, right?
So when did you get here to this room?
Yesterday and in the afternoon.
And do you think you'll be leaving in another day or something?
Maybe in another day, probably by tomorrow.
And then you're going to go to the border. You're going to get in the immigration process in the U.S. You have to convince U.S. officials that you have a credible fear.
Yes,
like they say, credible fear.
That's the first thing, the
right.
Credible fear. And
do you have any document? I mean, how do you do that? Do you have any documentation, or you're just going to tell your story like you just told us and hope they believe you?
Yes, that's what I hear. And the first time you have to speak with the truth, right, and say everything what is happening. But and after when you have the court, then you can show all the proof that you have. That's what I hear. But even if they ask for something, yes, I do. I have some papers with me that can show that why I'm running out from my country, right?
Do the cartels, when they do the extortion, do they ever give you any? Do they give you written warnings or threats, or they just come and talk to you?
No, warnings, threats.
Verbal.
Yes,
so
I do.
You don't have anything showing that.
Yes, I do. Yes, like the text message from WhatsApp and stuff like that.
Okay.
Yeah, and also they came to my business. They closed my business. I got proof of where I was located and also invoices and stuff like that, right? And so many things that can prove that.
Like Nelson, Rosa from southern Mexico lost her business, her farm, and all she owned to violence. She gave up waiting for her turn to apply for asylum in the U.S. because the process was too onerous. I met her in a shelter on the Mexican side of the border.
Tenía mi negocio, tenía mis animales, mis tierras para sembrar, todo.
I had my little business, my animals, my lands where I planted crops, everything.
Nomás que llegaron y nos asaltaron y nos quitaron la tienda, nos robaron todo.
They came and assaulted us. They took our store. They stole everything from us. That's why we fled.
Muchas gracias al gobierno y a las personas que nos han ayudado, que ayudan.
Many thanks to the government and to the people helping us.
Yo no traía ni segunda ropa y me han regalado ropa.
I didn't have a change of clothes. They gave me clothes.
Me han regalado zapatos.
They
me
gave
han regalado
me shoes.
Comida.
They gave me
aquí
food.
Me dan cobija.
They gave me blankets.
Pues Dios los bendiga.
May God
Dios
bless them and help
ayudando,
them to help others.
Que sigan ayudando a más personas. No sufre uno tocante a
we
la
don't
comida.
Suffer here,
nada
except
más está fuera
that it
de su casa,
isn't our home. That report was by Melinda Tuhus. Some of it aired in her series, The Forest and the Trees, on Community Radio WPKN. On June 7th, President Trump reportedly announced that Mexico had agreed to keep all Latin American asylum applicants on their side of the U.S. border pending individual court decisions in the U.S. Results remain to be seen. To hear Wings shows again, email wings@wings.org or visit the website wingsradio.org. Big thank you to all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose latest book is titled The Maternal Roots of the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.